Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, everybody. I'm David Green. Well, Donald Trump is pretty well known for his off-the-cuff comments at rallies and campaign events. Some of them are newsworthy, some of them are a little more ridiculous, some both, I think we could say. But the ears of many here in the United States and also abroad perked up when Trump made these comments recently. He was talking about leaders of NATO countries.
They asked me that question. One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" I said, "You didn't pay? You're delinquent?" He said, "Yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills."
Sounded like he was encouraging Russia to do whatever the hell they want to this NATO country if they had not paid their bills. Trump was saying these things as he explained his opposition to a $95 billion foreign aid package that included funding for both Ukraine and Israel. So is this just Trumpian absurd hyperbole, or should we anticipate an historic, radical, potentially dangerous change in U.S. foreign policy if he's elected? Or maybe it's somewhere in between. Well, let's start there. We have our left, right, and center panel back together again. Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch, is back after a week off. And Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. Nice to have the team back in place.
Hey, gang.
Hi.
So should we be freaking out? I mean, is Donald Trump really saying to a NATO country that if you don't pay up, that Russia can do whatever the hell they want? I'm struggling because it was eye-catching, it was headline-grabbing, and we should take and a presidential candidate's word seriously, but also it's pretty consistent with, you know, his vision and policy for NATO while he was president, which was putting pressure on NATO countries to pay their fair share, which we should say he got credit even from some of his critics for succeeding in pushing some countries to pay up. So what do you make of this, Sarah?
I think you're exactly right that we don't know, because the reason that Trump said that has nothing to do with what he would do as president. He says these things to get attention. He says these things to test out the crowd. I mean, part of his political genius is every day is a focus group with him. And so he sees how the crowd reacts and he tries out new lines. And then that does become policy based on whether it's popular. I mean, it's the truest form of populism. So whether he would actually do it in office, he doesn't even know that answer yet. I think it'll depend on how popular it is at his rallies. I think it'll depend on what types of people he brings into an administration. I've talked about this before, but, you know, obviously I worked in the Trump administration. And generally speaking, the people who worked in the Trump administration were vilified. And yet at the same time, a whole bunch of people want those people to now come back to the second Trump administration to keep the trains on the track. And it's like, well, that's not how that's going to work. And, you know, it matters that what Trump's saying here, you know, first of all, the only time that Article 5 of the NATO Charter has been invoked was for us. It was post 9/11. And there's at least some pretty good math out there that if the U.S. were to withdraw from NATO, it would actually cost us more money, because we rely on a lot of the stuff that our NATO allies have, so we don't have to have it ourselves. Who knows? But all I'm pretty certain of is that it doesn't reflect Trump's already decided policy position, right? It reflects a political moment that Trump thinks he does well with. And frankly, us talking about it is exactly what he wants.
Yeah. And we should say, I mean, you brought up Article 5, which is really at the core of what a lot of people are worried about here. It states in the charter that if you are a NATO country that is attacked, then other NATO countries will come to your defense. And like you said, Sarah, that happened with 9/11. And Mo, you have President Biden calling these comments appalling and dangerous. You have Charles Q. Brown Jr., the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, saying U.S. credibility is at stake with each of our alliances and U.S. leadership is still needed, wanted, and watched. And that's all in question now. But as Sarah said, like, this reaction might be exactly what Trump is going for. So how should we handle stuff like this? And there's going to be a lot more of it in this campaign.
Look, we should take it very, very seriously, whether or not he actually means it. As long as he keeps saying it, we should take it very, very seriously. Because while we sit here and discuss whether or not we should believe it, What really concerns me is whether or not foreign leaders believe it. An alliance is only as good as its members' ability to trust one another. And if our NATO partners do not trust that the United States under a President Trump will be there for them, that puts tremendous pressure on that alliance and how it operates. And more importantly, or equally as importantly, if our foreign adversaries think that there's any chance this is true, if Vladimir Putin thinks there's any chance that this is true, if China, which is looking at its own geopolitical standing and maybe making moves against Taiwan, which is not NATO, but if our foreign adversaries think the United States will not live up to its defense treaties, then suddenly it gives them a lot more opportunity. And finally, those countries that are not part of the alliance, that are not in a defense pact with the United States, does hearing things like this give them pause in their dealings with the United States moving forward if they do not trust us, or do they then start to turn to some of our adversaries? China is really playing hard in, you know, what's known as soft diplomacy. And they are courting nations in Latin America. They are courting nations in Africa. And if the leaders of those countries think the United States is not going to be there for their allies, maybe they'll decide that another country ought to be their ally. So it does do tremendous damage the more he says it. Whether or not he actually means it, the more he says it, it is putting our standing internationally at risk.
Well, let me ask you, Mo, do you see some value if we look at the actual policy that we saw under Trump's first presidency, trying to get European countries and NATO to pony up and share the burden more with the United States? I mean, if that's what Trump is going for here, you know, setting aside your very important thoughts on how this can be a dangerous message to other foreign leaders, is that a legitimate policy debate? Should the United States not take on as much of the burden, and should more NATO countries spend more of their GDP on policing the world?
Yes, they should. And every president, Republican and Democrat, has called for that. And so Donald Trump does deserve some credit for seeing for putting some pressure on them during his administration, just as Barack Obama deserves credit for trying to put pressure on them during his administration. Every U.S. president should be calling for our NATO allies to live up to their end of the bargain. And to be clear, right, that it's not the way he characterizes it. It's not that they're not paying their bills to NATO. NATO actually has a very, very, very small budget. It is the commitment by each member nation to spend at least 2% of their GDP on national defense. Some countries are exceeding that. Poland, I think, is close to 4. Other countries were falling short, and we've started to see a rise. And that's a good thing. Now, there are a lot of people out there that question why they started to grow their defense budgets. And it may not all be because of Donald Trump's bluster. They may be looking more at Vladimir Putin's actions over the past few years than Donald Trump's words. When he went into Crimea, that sent up a major red flag, shockwaves across Europe. And so that's when you started to see several European nations begin to increase their spending on defense. And frankly, as the war in Ukraine has gone on, European nations have been ponying up more funding than the United States has. So we are seeing a rise. We should continue to see that rise. But the second it becomes that transactional, the second NATO becomes a situation where you will only get defended if you do this, suddenly the alliance begins to fray at a very, very dangerous time as Putin is looking past Ukraine at Poland, at other nations. We have to demonstrate unity, not air this sort of division.
It's a more mercenary style of foreign policy, one would say, less based on values, less based on commitments, less based on treaties, and a little more mercenary. Is that? I mean, we've talked about together on this show how America's foreign policy values, at least in the eyes of a lot of voters and Americans, it's changing. You know, the idea of being, you know, police of the world, it's changing. So, I mean, Sarah, what do you see as the shift that this might represent, that Trump might be tapping into?
I mean, look, by the way, just the way negative polarization has pushed the two parties to something 180 degrees or so away from where they were 20 years ago.
100%.
Which is fascinating. It shows you how the realignment and who the voters are for those parties is accelerating. I mean, there's all sorts of things that this is like a symptom of and downstream from. But David, here's the thing I'm going to return to as we talk about Donald Trump for the next 9 months. A Donald Trump second term has a much wider spectrum of possibilities than I think any presidential candidate that we've ever seen, certainly in our lifetime. And, you know, I think wager from the beginning of the Republic, in the sense that I think there is a real chance that Donald Trump's second term looks a lot like Donald Trump's first term. And I'm sure lots of people listening to this didn't like the policies, that it was a lot of chaos. But look, by and large, it was within the Overton window of, American presidencies. And then there's, you know, sort of the middle of the spectrum, which is maybe more chaos, more cabinet official turnover. Maybe the cabinet officials are never Senate confirmed, so it's a lot of acting. And you keep moving down the spectrum, and you can get all the way to it's bananas and he refuses to leave office and he pulls us out of NATO. He sides with Putin and all of a sudden we become part of the Axis powers, basically. And look, I think, let me give you the one on the far side of the other spectrum. Donald Trump, knowing that he's a lame duck, decides he wants to have a totally different reputation and cuddles up to the Democrats in order to have,
I mean, we're laughing, but I recognize that you can't predict. I mean, every option is on the table.
Right.
Every option's on the table. And maybe that's, 1% that he sides with Democrats and passes a national right to abortion. Maybe it's 1% that he refuses to leave office, pulls us out of NATO, and we're part of the Axis. And then there's everything in between at varying percentages as well. What I guess then is interesting to me politically is that there's lots of voters who understand that, but think that sort of the sure thing of a Biden second term, which let's talk about then the spectrum of the Biden, second term, which is some chance Biden does exactly what he's done this time. Some chance that Biden is out of office pretty quickly into his second term and Kamala Harris becomes president. Some chance he moves a little further to the left. Like it's all very, it's sort of a more tight spectrum there. Much tighter. That's a sure enough spectrum of things that they would rather take the chance, let's call it the 90% chance that Trump is sort of a relatively normal president that they think he's going to be, and they accept that there's a 10% chance that he might be cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, but that's better than the 100% chance of Biden. And that's a really interesting decision for voters. It's like gambling, but with presidential candidates.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break as we talk about gambling with the future of our country. Mo and Sarah and I are going to come back to talk more about the 2024 race and the mental readiness of potential presidential candidates. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Mo Alathy and Sarah Isger are here. We've talked about some of the leadership questions surrounding the two likely nominees for president of the United States. When it comes to foreign policy, we were just talking about that in the last segment. But there's this other set of broader questions that keep popping up for both Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and that's their ability to lead at all. A report from special counsel Robert Hur seemed to put to rest concerns about President Biden's mishandling of classified documents. But meanwhile, it set off alarms about the president's memory and alertness. Biden brought reporters in for a press conference and said that his memory is fine. And then a few minutes later, he mixed up the presidents of Egypt and Mexico. Donald Trump has made some of his own similar gaffes, which all leads me to say, John Stewart, good timing. Welcome back.
One thing we know for certain is this. We have two candidates who are chronologically outside the norm of anyone who has run for the presidency in this country, in the history of this country. They are the oldest people ever to run for president, breaking by only 4 years the record that they set. The last time they ran. We're not suggesting neither man is vibrant, productive, or even capable. But they're both stretching the limits of being able to handle the toughest job in the world. What's crazy is thinking that we are the ones, as voters, who must silence concerns and criticisms. It is the candidate's job to assuage concerns, not the voter's job not to mention them.
Okay, that was John Stewart making his return to The Daily Show with some observations on where things stand with these two candidates. A lot to talk about here. Mo, can we start with the violent reaction from some people, like furious at John Stewart for going here? I mean, come on. This is fair game for both of these guys who are running for president to talk about some of these moments, right?
Yeah. And anyone that can't take a joke needs to learn how to chill out.
Thank you.
Look, I think... seriously, if we're not going to learn how to laugh at ourselves, this is going to be a very, very long year for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, look, here's my take on this. Both guys are old. No question. So we can sit here and talk about how concerned we are about it. And I'm not suggesting what John Stewart is suggesting that or what John Stewart was pushing back on that, you know, we shouldn't. That people are trying to silence the concern of the voter. No, voters can be concerned about this. But at the end of the day, we have to make a choice. And that choice is going to be between Joe Biden or Donald Trump or a third candidate. And so we should, and what I hope voters do over the next year, is take a look at that choice seriously and figure out who they think is best able to lead. Joe Biden, in a hastily called press conference to push back on questions about his age, accidentally called the president, mixed up the presidents of Egypt and Mexico. And 90 minutes later, Donald Trump, at a rally, said that Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, was the leader of Turkey, literally 90 minutes after what Joe Biden said. Both guys have a long history of mixing up names. You know, I do that. Everybody does that. The other day I was yelling at my dog and I accidentally called him by my son's name, right? Like, we do things
I'm
like
guilty
that.
Too. Yeah.
So my problem is not, and this is where I don't typically push back on the press, but I think the press loves to focus on those flubs. What got lost was the context in which each of them made those flubs. Because following Joe Biden's poorly timed flub on the presidents of Egypt and Mexico, he went on to give a very cogent analysis of the situation in the Middle East. Now, you may not disagree with his standing on that, right? But if you listen to him, he gave a thoughtful, cogent analysis of the situation in the Middle East, in which he pushed back on Prime Minister Netanyahu, right? It was a statement that demonstrated a command of the situation. Donald Trump made his flub in the context of praising a foreign authoritarian dictator. If we want to talk about what sets someone apart and what makes someone prepared to be president, if we want to talk about acuity and the ability to do the job. That's what I hope people judge it on. Not how frail they look, not how many flubs they make, you know? Now, a lot of people are going to say both guys are not what I'm looking for, and so maybe I should look at one of the third-party candidates in the race.
Right.
Robert F. Kennedy got a lot of attention this week when he, at the Super Bowl, aired a takeoff of his uncle John Kennedy's famous 1960 campaign ad, and you saw interest in him.
People are so desperate for another option. Right? I mean, they're just like, right? Anyone, please.
But this is a guy who is against all vaccines, any vaccine, every vaccine. So again, measure that, right? Measure that when judging someone's ability to be president, not the flubs that they make, because we all make those flubs.
Well, Sarah, before I bring you in here, you had an interesting development, because what triggered a lot of this conversation was the special counsel, Robert Hur, talking about these classified documents, saying in his report that he was concerned about Biden's memory. Couple things I want our listeners to know, and tell me if I have this right. You worked with Robert Hur and know him from your time in the Justice Department in the Trump administration, and there's a chance that you might actually be giving him some advice as this thing goes forward. What exactly is happening?
So yes, worked very closely with Rob Hur. He was the sort of deputy attorney general during the Mueller investigation. You know, that's a position where all of the trains run through for the entire Department of Justice through that job. So I talked to him every single day, pretty much, when he was working in that job. So Rob, by the way, that makes him the only person to have worked on both special counsel investigations into the two candidates who are running for president this time, which is a like fun Rob Hur fact. Rob and I remain friends, et cetera. But yeah, so like late this week, Rob called and was like, "Hey, Sarah, I haven't been called to Congress yet, but like, I presume that's going to happen. Is that something you could help me with?" And we kind of had a conversation about it. He didn't offer me a job. I didn't accept or turn down a job that hadn't been offered to me. 3 hours later, a reporter called and said, "We heard you're helping Rob Hur," because that's how DC works. So I do want to disclose that I had that conversation with a friend of mine. To be honest, I have similar-ish conversations with like lots of my former DOJ colleagues all the time, depending on what's going on in their lives. It's just this one happens to be super front page news.
But it gives me, it places you at a place where I'm even more curious to know what you think of this piece. A lot of the conversation about Hur, and I think a lot of the questions he'll get, particularly from Democrats, if he testifies in Congress, is, you know, what was it your role? Was it the role of a special counsel to directly point to questions about the mental acuity of the sitting president of the United States? I mean, to me, it's like a doctor, or, you know, if the White House released a, you know, medical report on Joe Biden. But was this the appropriate place for this to happen and for all of us to be talking about this now because of it?
So a few things. One, let me just explain the special counsel role. Under statute, the special counsel is required to give a fulsome report to the attorney general on his recommendation of whether to pursue charges or not. That's not the case in other DOJ matters, for instance. So when you give that report, there's three things that a federal prosecutor has to meet to bring charges. One, they have to believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the person is guilty. Two, they have to believe that they have the evidence that they can use in court to prove that the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt as well. But three, and this is what's a little unique to the Department of Justice and that's in the Justice Manual, you have to believe that you'll win at trial, that you'll get a conviction from a jury. So you have to believe that a jury will believe that the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The reason that that's relevant is because when Rob Hur walked through his four reasons why, for instance, he was not recommending indictments on the marked classified, you know, TSSCI, the highest clearance documents that were found in Biden's home about the Afghanistan war, one was that the Afghanistan war was over. The documents were quite old, so the risk to national security, that wasn't, you know, an aggravating factor. Two, he noted that Joe Biden both as vice president and as president, was allowed to have the documents in his home. It was just for this interim period between the two, those 4 years, that he would have been willfully retaining national security information. And that despite having a recording in 2017 during that period where Joe Biden says to his ghostwriter, "Oh, I found the classified documents in the basement." I mean, he basically is saying he's willfully retaining classified documents. So HERS got to show why it doesn't meet all three of those standards, despite having like pretty much a smoking gun that you never have in willful retention cases. And that's where you get to number three, which is he did not believe that a jury would convict Joe Biden because of the way that Joe Biden presented himself in the interview with the special counsel, which was 5 hours over 2 days. What he's saying in this report is basically he's not sure that a jury will buy that he willfully retained the documents versus said that he found them and then the next day forgot type thing.
And so he had to explain in the report that this is the reason that he would not suggest filing charges.
That's right. And I think the choice, if you're mad about that, if you're mad that he included it, consider the option. So assume for a moment that it actually is part of Rob Herr's calculus. Then your option is, it is part of his calculus. He is required by statute to provide that reason to his boss, but he decides not to because he's going to make a political determination not to do that. Or, you just like put in the stuff and it's actually up to AG Garland, whether to release the report, redact the report, et cetera. And remember, the likelihood that the transcript of that interview will become public is like 100%. From this point, it's going to go through declassification review. Each of the intelligence communities are going to, you know, have to look at it and redact stuff that they think is still classified. And then it'll go through the White House for executive privilege review. But that thing is coming out. And when it does, then look, all of this chatter from Democrats, frankly, and Republicans about Rob Herr's report is going to be totally beside the point because everyone's going to be able to see it for themselves and make their own decision about Joe Biden's mental acuity. And just a couple notes on what Mo said. One, I think talking about their age is totally beside the point. People have early onset Alzheimer's. People have, you know, Bernie Sanders is like insanely vibrant and old as anything.
Yeah, it's
I think
not
we should
just
stop
age.
Saying
I mean,
it's not age. Voters aren't concerned about their age per se. I mean, or rather, that's a separate issue. Maybe voters want someone from a new generation. That's an age concern. You know, you just don't get it. You don't know how the internet works. That's different than a mental acuity concern.
It also risks ageism by suggesting that, you know, oh, someone is getting old. They must have a lot of mental acuity issues, which is, as you're saying, is not the case. You can be in your 20s and 30s and have some serious issues.
But given that this transcript is going to come out, I'm just sort of stunned that the partisan pundits that I see are trying to like basically gaslight the American people into saying like, no, he has no mental acuity issues at all. The transcript's going to come out. Why not say basically a version of what Mo said? I've been wondering this for days. Why aren't they out there saying, yeah, look, he's old. He has some, you know, forgetful moments. But at the end of the day, you're going to get to pick between these two guys. So, yep, this guy forgets stuff, but he's also not going to end the republic. So, you know, you pick. Like, why not make that?
I think Sarah's making a really good point. Yeah, Mo, go ahead.
I want the Democrats to lean into mental acuity.
Right.
Stop being defensive, right?
Yes.
We can look exactly at, we got two guys here. They could have been high school classmates. They're so similar in age, right? They're only a couple of years apart. They both forget names. One of them follows the Constitution, the other does not. One of them supports NATO, the other does not, right? We could go through a whole litany and say, so you tell me which one is fit to be in office. That's a way to lean into it and change the framing of it. I don't think, right? We tend, Democrats have a natural, the two things that come naturally to us. One, we are natural bedwetters, and two, we constantly live in a defensive posture. Get out of that defensive posture on this one.
Yeah.
And say, yeah, let's talk about who is mentally fit to be in office. Let's talk about who is fit to control our armed forces. Let's talk about fitness. And then start drawing that, right? We all forget names, and we all are going to get older. That's not what's at stake here.
there's something, Mo, that and I look back to what we talked about in the very beginning and Trump's comments about NATO. There's something about the way that people on the left respond that does not feel like it's really working effectively right now. Like this whole thing over NATO, like you explained it really well. Like, let's focus on what this means. But I think there's a danger that it's like, there's the freak out, and then Trump can show his supporters, his populist supporters, like, see, they freak out whenever I say anything. Isn't that a fun game to play? And then, like, people like him more, and they wait for the next freak out. And then in this case, this like impulse to yell at John Stewart and yell at the special counsel and be like, this was inappropriate. It's someone's got to be someone like you
and
needs
look,
to be in there giving some more messaging advice, because this is not working.
Look, I'm with Sarah. I didn't find Jon Stewart's jokes that funny this time, which breaks my heart, because I think he's a hilarious person. I'm so glad he's back.
Well, it's kind of
sad.
By
focusing on age, I think he's missing the bigger point that Sarah articulated so well. You know, and yeah, I've got real problems with Robert Herr's inclusion of a specific phrase, right, to characterize the president. But turn it around, right? This is not a place for us to get whiny and complain about what others are saying. This is a chance for people on the left to step forward and say, you want to talk fitness for office? Game on.
Wow. Okay. Mo, Sarah, you both are landing the plane today, right before break. You're just landing things. And then we put an exclamation point and then go to a break and come back for more. And we're going to do just that right now. Sarah and Mo and I are going to come back in just a moment. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm with Sarah Isger and Mo Alethi. I'm David Green. You know, we've been working on this 50 states project on the show here in 2024. It's given us the chance to go take a look at a story state by state. Each one, we hope, teaching us something about our politics and our larger national conversation from the ground up. And we're going to go this week to Georgia, where there's been an ongoing conversation about affirmative action and questions about what equal rights should mean. Last year, the topic of affirmative action centered around university admissions. And then following the Supreme Court's ruling restricting admissions on the basis of race, the conversation has now headed to the boardroom. The American Alliance for Equal Rights has filed a lawsuit against the Fearless Fund, which is a venture capital fund that aims to provide early rounds of financing to businesses led by women of color. The director of the fund is Arian Simone, and you're going to hear her voice here in a story from Atlanta News First.
The American Alliance for Equal Rights claims a Fearless Fund program violates the Civil Rights Act of 1866 because they have members who are being excluded from a grant program specifically for black women business owners. In response, Simone says their work for black women is vital.
We've been in touch with all of our investors. They stand by their DEI programs. They stand by their commitments that they've made post-George Floyd to the black community. They are in agreement with the work that they have done and the work they are doing with us.
Statistics show black female-owned businesses are growing but are underfunded.
Okay, so again, this is in Georgia, and this lawsuit centers on the Fearless Fund's Strivers Grant Contest, which awards $20,000 to businesses that are majority-owned by black women. This grant award was blocked by court order, though there was a hearing in late January where the fund's lawyers appealed to restore the grant while the lawsuit is ongoing. And so this is still a conversation. It's an open question where this will go. And Sarah, Mo, I bring this up because I feel like, you know, we have this big question hanging over all of it.
Can I read you a quote that I keep on my desk? It's from Justice Jackson in a concurrence from last term. And it says, other cases presenting different allegations and different records may lead to different conclusions. And so often I feel like in our political conversations, our legal conversations, that perhaps we forget that, yeah, the individual facts should matter.
So you're saying that each case is different. I mean, that's that I should be focusing less on, like, let's draw one big broad lesson here and answer the big, deeper question.
Both. I mean, it's fine to have deeper questions and philosophical conversations, but trying always to compare individual cases and situations to one another only work if they're identical. And when they're not, we should be clear that they're not.
Right. It's like saying that the results of one special election can portend like what's going to happen in the next national one. So I agree. But David, I think what you are positing is real and right, that we are seemingly at a point where just the whole issue of how we tackle this is being pushed to the front. And I think it's legitimate, right? I think it is a legitimate conversation for us to be having, because to me, putting aside the individual cases, like forget about this Georgia case, but there seems to me to be a big debate about whether or not, as you put it, we should be owning up to the fact that certain communities have been denied access, the same access to opportunity as others historically throughout this nation, right? That is actually the fundamental question. And there seems to be a bright line being drawn between those who say, yes, structurally they have been denied opportunity versus those who say, no, there's no structural denial. And then secondly, if so, what do we do about it, right? Those are two questions that we are asking. One, does it exist? And two, should we do anything about it? It's not just a political debate. This is a social, cultural sense of identity debate that's happening. I, not surprisingly, fall on the side of saying, yes, certain communities have been denied, structurally, have been denied access to certain opportunities while others have thrived. I also, not surprisingly, fall on the side that to the extent possible, we should find ways to break down some of those barriers moving forward. So if a VC fund, a privately owned entity, wants to dedicate funding to certain communities that typically have not had access to the same capital, to the same opportunity, I think that's a good thing. But there are those who are going to push back saying that then acknowledges something we refuse to acknowledge, and that there were these structural barriers. And I think that's at the heart of this. And it's a really important question that one would have hoped we would have resolved by now. I'm not sure we will resolve it.
I think your first part's a bit of a straw man. What people are saying when they see this story is, okay, so you're fine with a private VC fund then only giving money to white men and saying they do not give money to people of color. Because under the law, there's no real way to distinguish between, quote, positive racial discrimination and negative racial discrimination. It's part of what we saw in the Harvard case. Agree or disagree with the outcome, but the fact is, if you're putting the thumb on the scale for one group based solely on the color of their skin, you're discriminating against another group based solely on the color of their skin. In this case, it was Asian students who were discriminated against in favor of basically non-Asian students, actually. The white students, the black students, the Latino students were all benefiting on the backs of the Asian students.
Well, but Sarah, that's bringing up this really important point. And Simone, the founder of this fund, addressed exactly what you just said. And I want to play her response and see what you think, because that you bring up the other question here. Like, is if you are, can there be any distinction when you are favoring a certain group based on something like race or gender? And here's the way she described it on CBS News.
My biggest takeaway, the opposing counsel compared our program to the whites only sign during segregation. Mm. And afterwards, reporters said, how did that make you feel? And I explained that the whites only sign during segregation, one, was used to oppress people, but it was not solving a disparity. The work that we do is actually solving a disparity. We are looking to level the playing field. We're trying to make things equitable and equal. And that's why we do the work we do. But I do believe in the same thing that Edward Blum does. He's on the plaintiff side. And people are like, what's that? And I'm like, I want a world where race doesn't matter too. He says that's what he wants. I want that too. We're just not there yet.
So Sarah, to your point, I want to let you finish, but is if you are solving a disparity, is that an important distinction that allows some programs like this to be fair and right under the law and others not?
No. because after the Civil War, we decided that we were not going to allow discrimination on the basis of race anymore, that race alone could not be how you determine someone's worth. And by the way, we still didn't live up to that promise for another nearly 100 years. And so the idea that I'm going to trust the government, for instance, to make a decision over who's oppressed and who's the oppressor, absolutely not. And then to the question of a private organization, you know, these are our a version of our public accommodation laws. It's the reason why we could say you can't ban Black people from your hotel. It's the same reason we say you can't ban Jews from your bookstore. It's all the same 14th Amendment argument. We decided as a country that we were not going to allow people to be judged that way, in a good way, in a bad way. Because look, when you say you're only going to give money to Black women because of a historical disadvantage, oppression, are you saying that just because of their skin color, you know that? Because what about someone who just moved here from Africa last year? They did not face historical oppression in this country. They just got here. And the same thing we saw again in, you know, the higher education stuff, right? What if you come from a really rich family that just got here? What if you come from a really poor family? When you start judging people on race, we made that decision that we think that's insidious no matter what. Even if you tell them it's for their own good and positive, it puts a badge on them that they are less than, not as good, and that they're being judged not by who they are, what they've accomplished or anything else, but by the color of their skin.
But then what are the solutions to correcting these historical disparities and addressing discrimination? Like, I want there to be solutions, and I feel like programs like this are the solution. Like, and I guess this speaks to this conversation debate we're having right now is very much reflective of what's happening in the country.
There would be no lawsuit to be filed if this VC fund, for instance, said, tell us about how your life or your family had been institutionally or historically discriminated against or oppressed, and then we fund based on that. That would be no problem. It's the same thing with, why I attacked Harvard. Actually, the record in Harvard is that these admissions counselors were just lazy. They had every opportunity to actually make a class that was diverse. They chose not to because it was a lot easier to just use skin color, not what someone was going to add to the class, their life experience. All the things they said were the reasons they needed to use skin color were things they could have gotten to not using skin color. It's just not that hard. Ask the question. Do a little research. But judging someone on the color of their skin, we banned in 1868.
I think I tend to fall more along the lines of where your question was, David, that there are undeniable historical inequities, undeniable blockages to opportunity that are just undisputed. And so finding ways to ensure that access, right? It's the whole, HBCUs are educational institutions set up to avoid and to try to level that playing field. Title IX is something that was established to eliminate some of those barriers, right? I guess I hear your argument, and I'm not a lawyer, but it feels like that argument could actually be one that is used to roll back Title IX, right? To say, that putting funding into supporting one particular community should not be allowed. And that's dangerous, right? If a private firm says that it's not going to deny access, it's going to increase access to a certain community, I think that is one way to begin to address this. And it's one that's not driven by the government.
Mo, I'm just thinking this through. What do you think of Sarah's message there, that programs like this might be more legally sound and protected in the future if they are not just and explicitly about skin color, for example, but that there needs to be an added layer of someone who is getting funding in a program like this to show that there's another reason that they deserve to be helped by a program like this? I will say I'm really struggling with this because I think that discrimination and racism in our country has been about skin color. And so to have programs that make up for that, morally, I think it's the right thing to do. I'm just raising this because, you know, Sarah brought up the law, and I wonder what you think of that, if that would make these programs more sound.
I think I'm not a lawyer, but I'm with you that these I'm with you. Racism is caused by discrimination against skin color, and we should make it as simple as possible to get past that. We don't ask people in rural communities how living in a rural community has impacted and caused them struggle in their lives when we set up VC funds that give money only to rural companies in order to overcome that. If it's okay to focus on the real obstacles to opportunity there, I don't understand why it's not okay to focus on the real obstacles to opportunity given to Black people, to Black women-owned businesses, as in this case in Atlanta, to Latinos, to many of the other communities that have. Why add an extra layer for them that we are not asking of others?
All right. Well, obviously, this conversation reflects the deeper conversation happening in our country right now, and I'm glad we covered it together. All right, we're going to leave it there. It is time now for our left, right, and center rants and raves. Sarah, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, there was kind of a crazy story that got published in the New York Times Magazine. Their personal financial writer, in the end, put $50,000 cash from her bank account into a shoebox and handed it to a stranger. It was a scam, and she writes about this full scam that she fell for. She's not elderly. She's not dumb. And on the one hand, she's trying to explain how, like, wow, I'm not the type of person who would fall for a scam. On the other hand, man, I was left thinking, that's still insane. At the point they're saying they're putting you on with the CIA and you're in danger and everything else, like, nope, call 911, call a lawyer. Just anytime you're taking cash out of your bank account and giving it to someone you don't know, that alone, that should be enough. I don't know, man.
Okay, Mo, the floor is yours.
This week, on Valentine's Day, we saw yet another mass shooting, this time at a parade in Kansas City celebrating the Chiefs' Super Bowl win when gunfire erupted in the street and there were multiple casualties. We have now had more mass shootings in 2024 than we have had days in 2024. And it continues to break my heart that, one, it continues to happen, and two, that we as a society still haven't figured out or come to any sort of consensus on how to deal with it. On that day, some of the survivors of previous mass shootings, Parkland and Uvalde, held a rally outside of the Capitol, or a protest outside of the Capitol, in which they also unveiled their latest advocacy tool, AI-generated calls of their children who were victims of these shootings, calling members of Congress, asking them to do something so that AI voices would no longer needed to be used to do so, so that future children wouldn't have to have their voices replicated by AI to make these calls.
Hello, I'm Joaquin Oliver. 6 years ago, I was a senior at Parkland. Many students and teachers were murdered on Valentine's Day that year by a person using an AR-15, but you don't care. You never did. It's been 6 years and you've done nothing, not a thing to stop all the shootings that have continued to happen since.
The whole situation is gut-wrenching. Hearing those calls was gut-wrenching. And I don't even know what I'm asking for anymore other than for us to do something about this problem.
Well, let's talk about it more on our show for more than just a minute. Let's dig into gun violence and firearms and do what we do and have a real conversation about it. So that's my pledge. And we're obviously thinking about the people of Kansas City and everyone who has been touched by this. Mo, Sarah, thank you as always. Thank you also to the fabulous team who put this show together every week. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark A. Green, and our executive producers, Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards, and Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. And real special heartfelt thanks to the great team here at WITF in Harrisburg. This was my mom's public radio station. This was my public radio station when I was in high school in central Pennsylvania. It's always great being here and feeling part of the family. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we're distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Come back next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.